scream. There was no mistaking the hair-raising wail, and he chose to believe that it was the one he'd been seeking. The sooner the feline returned to its territory, the better. This was truly a matter of life and death, although not Twilly's own. On the trail leading back to camp, he encountered the kid.
"You're supposed to be in school," Twilly said.
"I dreamed I saw the cat."
"Where?"
"On the boardwalk," said Duane Scrod, Jr.
"I had to check it out in case it was, like, an Indian dream. But it wasn't."
"Too bad."
Twilly himself rarely dreamed, but he knew Seminoles and McCusickies who had visions that sometimes came true. Facing the sun, Duane Scrod, Jr. squinted out across the swamp.
"So you didn't find anything? No tracks?"
Twilly shook his head.
"A bobcat and some deer, that's all.
You saw that chopper, right?"
"Don't worry," Duane Scrod, Jr. said. "They didn't see me. I hid the bike real good, too."
"You need to get your butt to school. The alternative isn't pretty."
"Yeah, I know.
Did your book bag ever turn up?"
"Nope.
I swear I took it home," the kid said. "But I can't find it anywhere. Weird."
"You ask your old man?"
Duane Scrod Jr. snorted. "He's locked inside his music room with that crazy bird. Says he chased off a government tax man, and next they're going to send the FBI. There's no use talking to him when he gets like this."
The boy clearly had a rocky situation at home. His mother had run off to Europe, and his father didn't always have both oars in the water. Twilly Spree felt bad for him, although not bad enough to risk blowing the mission.
"Hey, I saw the bottles got here," Duane Scrod Jr. said.
"Yep. Everybody's okay for now."
"That was a cool thing you did."
"Go to school," Twilly told him. "Don't make me say it again."
"Right. Later, dude."
Watching the boy walk away, Twilly wished that he were better qualified to give out advice and wisdom. However, he'd spent most of his own life following his gut impulse instead of his brain, so he was hardly the proper model of a sensible grown-up. He headed back toward camp, moving quietly by habit through the marshes and prairies and tree islands. On a soggy stretch, he came upon something dark in the middle of the trail, something that hadn't been there earlier in the morning. Twilly dropped to the ground and put his face closer in order to be sure. Eagerly, he studied the fresh find. He poked it with a twig. He turned it with a leaf. He even sniffed it. There was no doubt. Panther poop. Dr. Dressler's day turned sour when his lunch was interrupted by the arrival of George and Gilda Carson. They had come to make their weekly plea to have their brilliant son, Graham, moved up one or two grade levels at Truman. Based on Graham's most recent report card, which Dr. Dressler held in his hand, Graham was exactly where he should have been.
"He has a C-plus average," Dr. Dressler reminded the Carsons. "There's nothing wrong with that, but it tells me that your son has all the challenges he can handle right now."
"What do you mean by that?"
huffed Gilda Carson.
"Yes, what are you driving at?"
George Carson chimed in. Part of Dr. Dressler's job was putting up with the unreasonable demands of parents, but sometimes it wasn't easy to be polite.
"We don't normally advance a student unless he or she has straight A's," he explained, "and only then if they pass a series of tests showing that they're ready to skip ahead of all the other students their age."
Gilda Carson said,
"We told you to give Graham those tests."
"And I did." Dr. Dressler handed her a copy of the not-so-brilliant results, which she showed to her husband.
"Sorry he had one bad day. Big deal," said George Carson. "Let him take the tests again."
Dr. Dressler glanced wearily at the brass clock on his desk. He said,
"Graham is a fine young man. He pays attention in class. He asks lots and lots of questions. He tries hard, but..."
"But what?"
sneered Graham's mother.
But he's a C-plus student.
Which is the fault of his teachers, Dr. Dressler. Clearly, Graham is underachieving, George Carson said, waving the test paper. And that shouldn't happen at a place like Truman. We pay an arm and a leg for tuition here.
Dr. Dressler tuned out the arm and a leg speech, which he'd heard dozens of times from parents who decided to blame the school because their children were falling short of their expectations. More often than not, the students improved with a little extra help and went on to graduate with solid marks. However, the Carsons were in no mood for a pep talk, and Dr. Dressler was in no mood for the Carsons. He was on the verge of saying something very frank to them when his assistant cracked open the door.
Sorry to interrupt, Dr. Dressler, but Detective Marshall is here to see you.
Certainly, right away.
The headmaster was relieved to be rid of the Carsons, who departed, grousing. But he was worried about this new visit from the sheriff's detective. It probably wasn't a social call. Once Jason Marshall entered the office, he got directly to the point.
I'm here to arrest Duane Scrott, Jr., he said.
For the fire in the swamp?
The detective nodded soberly. Dr. Dressler's spirits sank as he envisioned the awful headline, Truman Student Busted for Arson. Because he was still a minor, Duane Scrott, Jr. could not be openly named by the authorities, although it hardly mattered. The news that anyone enrolled at Truman was being charged with such a serious crime would bring horrible publicity, and Dr. Dressler anticipated a strong reaction from the school's board of trustees, not to mention some of the wealthy donors.
The fire department called about an hour ago, Jason Marshall said. It sounded like they got all the evidence they need.
Dr. Dressler didn't bother asking for details. Given the boy's history of setting fires, the headmaster had no doubt that Duane Scrott, Jr. was guilty. Obviously, there was a good reason why the other students called him Smoke.
It's only 20 minutes until school's dismissed, Dr. Dressler said. Can't we wait?
The detective said, no. Let's get it over with.
Dr. Dressler checked the schedule and saw that Duane Scrott Jr. was in Mr. Riccio's English seminar.
It's probably better if you stay here, the headmaster told Jason Marshall, who agreed.
The classroom was on the other side of the campus, and Dr. Dressler hurried to get there. Duane Scrott Jr. showed little emotion when the headmaster tapped on the door and summoned him outside. Halfway to the administration building, the boy finally asked why he'd been called out of class.
"We've got a problem, Duane," said Dr. Dressler.
"What do you mean?"
"A man from the sheriff's department wants to speak with you."
"Again?
How come?" "Is your father home? Because you'll probably want to give him a call later."
"When hell freezes over," the boy said.
The Truman School had a strict rule against cussing, but Dr. Dressler let it slide. Duane Scrott Jr. was a large person, and the headmaster didn't want to rile him. He knew that the detective was far more experienced at handling such situations. Jason Marshall, it turned out, was waiting with a set of handcuffs.
"No way," muttered Duane Scrott Jr. when he realized what was happening. "I'm sorry, son," the detective said. "Turn around, please."
The boy didn't move. He sighed heavily and rolled his eyes toward the ceiling.
"This is so wrong," he said.
Dr. Dressler was now extremely nervous. Nobody had ever been arrested in his office before.
"Duane, please do what Detective Marshall says." Slowly, very slowly, the boy turned around. "Thank goodness," thought the headmaster.
Then, just as Jason Marshall stepped forward to snap on the handcuffs, Duane Scrott Jr. bolted out the door.
"Hey!" shouted the detective, charging after him.
"Stop!"
Dr. Dressler stood there alone, dumbfounded and flustered. He felt like he was in an episode of Cops. The headmaster looked out the window in time to see Duane Scrod Jr. sprinting toward the athletic field. For such a stocky kid, he was very quick, and he steadily widened the gap between himself and the detective. Dr. Dresler wondered why nobody had ever talked Duane Scrod Jr. into playing for the Truman football team, which was in dire need of a fullback. A lacrosse squad was practicing at the west end of the field, and Duane Scrod Jr. made a beeline for one of the players. Even from a distance, Dr. Dresler easily identified the student as Nick Waters because of the bulky sling contraption that he wore on his right shoulder. The headmaster watched in puzzlement as Duane Scrod Jr. pulled Nick aside and spoke to him briefly. Then the boy again dashed away, jumping a chain-link fence and vanishing into a deep stand of pine trees. Detective Jason Marshall ran far behind, waving and hollering. Dr. Dresler didn't think that Duane Scrod Jr. had any friends at the Truman School, so he wondered why the kid had singled out Nick Waters to speak to, and what message could have been so important as to prompt him to interrupt his escape. Had Dr. Dresler been able to hear every word that Duane Scrod Jr. said on the practice field, he might have reserved his opinion about the arson in the Black Vine Swamp. The first thing that the boy called Smoke told Nick Waters was, "Your biology book's in my locker. The combination is 535. And the second thing he said was, "I didn't do that fire, man. I'm innocent." 17. When Nick got home from school, he saw his father in the backyard throwing baseballs left-handed into the pitching net. Nick dropped his blazer on a chair, yanked off his necktie, and ran outside. "How's your, you know?" He pointed at his dad's bandaged shoulder. "My stump, you mean?" His father smiled ruefully. "Actually, it's more like a stump of a stump." Nick thought, at least he hasn't lost his sense of humor. His dad said, "Infection's almost gone, but I'd be lying if I said I felt like $1 million." "Then you should take it easy." "No, sir." Captain Gregory Waters grabbed another ball from a bucket by his feet. "Take off your sling, Nicky, and we'll play some catch." Nick knew it was useless to argue. "Throw it here," he said. "Unstrap your right arm and go get your glove." "Come on, Dad, just throw it." "Suit yourself." His dad wound up and pitched. The ball made a smack when it landed in Nick's bare hand, and it stung. "Whoa!" Nick whistled and shook his fingers. "That's pretty good." "I'm getting there," his father said. Nick tossed back the ball, which went straight enough, though not terribly hard. He still felt awkward throwing with the wrong arm. "Dad, how long have you been out here practicing?"
4 hours and change."
"Geez, you're not tired?" Greg Waters laughed.
"Are you kidding? I'm whipped," he said. "But it's the best way to build up my strength and get some muscle memory."
His next pitch was low and off the mark. Nick scooped it off the grass, took a big step, and hurled it back 5 feet over his father's head. Greg Waters chuckled and said, "Even when I had 2 arms, I couldn't jump that high." Nick retrieved the baseball from a bed of geraniums and jogged back to the other end of the yard. "Who's your favorite lefty of all time?" he asked his dad on the next throw.
"Steve Carlton of the Phillies, way before your time. But you should have seen his fastball."
"Better than Johan Santana's?"
"Ask me again when Johan is in the Hall of Fame." He zipped another one back at Nick, who didn't mind the sting.
It was exciting to see his dad throwing so hard and so accurately from what was once his weak side.
"So, Nicky, what's the hot news at Truman?"
Nick had planned to tell his parents about Smoke at dinner. They would have heard about it eventually anyway. "Levy's dad came to arrest a kid at school, only the kid ran off into the woods and got away," Nick said. Greg Waters stopped in the middle of his pitching motion. He lowered his arm but hung onto the ball.
"What was he being arrested for?"
"That fire in the swamp that I told you about the day we went on the field trip," Nick said. "But here's the thing, Dad.
I don't think he did it. How do you know?
The back door opened and Nick's mom came outside wearing a first baseman's mitt as big as a ham. She pounded her fist into the pocket and called out to Nick's dad, "Come on, soldier boy, let's see what you've got."
Greg Waters grinned and hurled the ball, which he snagged easily and threw underhanded, but with plenty of juice, to Nick. His mother hadn't played softball since college, but she still had an excellent arm.
"How long have you been home?" Nick asked her.
"About 30 seconds. I saw you two rookies out here in the yard and figured you needed some backup, or else you were going to break out some windows on Mrs. Storter's house."
"Not me," Nick's father said, pretending to be insulted. "Nick is a wild one."
For half an hour, they played three-way catch in a breezy, pleasant silence, just as they used to do before Greg Waters had been sent to Iraq. To Nick, it seemed unreal that not even 2 weeks had passed since his dad had been seriously wounded. Yet he was already back home, slinging the baseball. It was like a miracle, Nick thought. Then again, his father was no ordinary patient.
Greg Waters said, "Nick, tell your mom what happened at school today."
"Oh, I already know about it." Gilda Carson text messaged every parent in the phone book, said Nick's mother. "That boy who ran from the police is the same one who stopped over last night to borrow Nick's biology book."
"Really? Nicky didn't mention that."
Greg Waters looked concerned, but he kept on throwing. "His name is Dwayne Scott Jr.," Nick's mother said. "His dad did a stretch in jail for arson, so I guess the apple doesn't fall far from the tree."
"Mom, he didn't do it," Nick cut in firmly.
"What makes you so sure?"
"He told me so," Nick said. "While he was running away from Detective Marshall, he stopped me at lacrosse practice and said he was innocent. Why would he bother to do that if it wasn't true?"
Nick's mother tossed him the baseball.
"People do lie, Nicky, especially when they're in trouble. But I believe him. You guys didn't see the look in his eyes, but I did."
Nick heaved the ball to his dad, who bobbled it, and then dropped it on the grass. Obviously, he was distracted by what he was hearing. Nick's mom said, "Tell your father what the other kids call Dwayne Jr."
"Oh, it's just a nickname," Nick protested.
"Let's hear it," said his dad.
"Smoke,"
Nick said quietly, knowing it would be harder than ever to convince his parents that Dwayne Scrod Jr. was innocent.
"Smoke!"
Greg Waters picked up the baseball and turned it over and over in his hand.
"Let me guess why they call him Smoke."
"Because that's what he likes to be called. Nobody knows why," Nick said. Then he added,
"Okay, the police said he set two fires a long time ago, but that doesn't automatically mean he did this one."
Nick assumed that his mother had already learned about Smoke's previous arsons from Mrs. Carson, who'd probably gotten the information from Graham.
"Nicky, this doesn't sound good," his father said. "But what happened in the past shouldn't matter. If he didn't start this fire, he shouldn't be arrested for it," Nick said.
"That's not right, Dad."
Nick's mother walked over and put an arm around him, her softball mitt resting behind his back on the lump that was his wrapped-up right arm. She said,
"According to Mrs. Carson, they've got real strong evidence that Dwayne Jr. did it."
"Like what?"
She didn't say in the message, but she made it sound solid. Nick pulled away and sat down in a patio chair.
"Well, I don't believe that. Anyway, you're supposed to be innocent till proven guilty, right?"
"If Smoke was lying to me on the lacrosse field," Nick thought, "then that kid is the world's greatest actor."
"Did the police catch him?" he asked.
"Not yet," his mom said. "I'd better go start dinner. We can talk about this later." Captain Gregory Waters sat down, flexing the fingers in his left hand. He looked sore and exhausted.
"Maybe tomorrow I'll try the fly rod," he said.
Nick found himself staring at the empty right sleeve of his father's shirt. Getting used to the sight of him without one arm would take time. His dad even joked about how lopsided, he appeared in the mirror. "Can I ask you something about the war?" Nick said.
"Sure."
"That man who died when the rocket hit your Humvee, you said he was like a brother to you?"
"It's true, he was," Nick's father said.
"How long did you know him before then?"
Greg Waters thought for a moment.
"2 weeks, maybe three."
"That's not a very long time," Nick said.
"Well, sometimes you make a connection right away."
"And not just because you're, like, in battle together?"
"No. The same thing would happen when I played ball in the minors," said Nick's dad. "He'd start talking to a new player the first day of spring training, and right away, you knew he was okay. And then some other guy would walk up, and in 2 seconds you could tell he was a complete ass."
"I know what you mean," Nick said. "It's like a weird radar."
"Yeah, sort of." Nick stood up. "I need to make a phone call before dinner." His father said, "This boy that the police are hunting for, is he a friend of yours?"
"That's a good question," said Nick.
"I think maybe he is." After setting the table for his mom, Nick went to his bedroom, shut the door, and called Libby Marshall on her cell. She was out walking her dog, Sam.
"No, they didn't catch him yet," she said, anticipating Nick's question. "But they will. And my dad is so not amused. He pulled a hamstring while he was chasing him."
Nick had to be careful what he said to Libby. It was natural for her to believe that Smoke was guilty because that's what her father surely told her. Libby said, "He's still on probation for torching that billboard on the interstate. So they can lock him up until his next trial, my dad says. 6 months, maybe longer."
No wonder he ran away, Nick thought.
"Are they still out there looking for him?"
"Nah, he's not like a serial killer or something," Libby said. "They'll bust him as soon as he goes home. Dad says that's where they usually find juvenile fugitives."
"But what if he doesn't show up?"
"Right, Nick. Where else is he gonna go?"
Nick thought, "I wish I knew."
Why are they so sure he did it? Nick was hoping that Libby's father had mentioned something about the mysterious new evidence. And luckily, he had. "Somebody found Smoke's book bag near the place where the fire was started," Libby said. "Guess what was in it? A portable torch, just like the arsonist used." "He's toast, Nick. Case closed."
"His book bag from school? The camo one?"
"Hang on a second," Libby said. "Sam, no. Bad dog. Bad dog."
While she hollered at her pet, Nick held the phone away from his ear. It didn't make sense that Smoke's backpack had suddenly turned up at the Black Vine Swamp. When Libby came back on the line, she was out of breath.
"Sorry, Nick, I gotta go. Sam's cornered a humongous old tomcat, and it's about to scratch his nose off. No, bad boy, I said no!"
Nick hung up and immediately called Marta.
"What are you doing first thing tomorrow?" he asked.
"Sleeping," she replied. "It's Saturday, remember?"
"We're going on a bike ride."
"I don't think so, Nick. Be ready at 8.
"Get serious," said Marta. "I plan to be snoring like a polar bear at 8 o'clock in the morning."
"No, this is important. I'll explain everything when I see you."
"Don't you dare take me back to Mrs. Starch's house. I don't want to end up with glass eyeballs and a tag around my neck like all those other dead animals."
Nick said, "Don't worry, that's not where we're going."
The next morning, as Duane Scrout Sr. crept into the kitchen to get some sunflower seeds for Nadine, he heard a knock at the front door and then a voice calling,
"Duane, are you there?"
It sounded too young to be an FBI man, but Duane Scrout Sr. wasn't taking any chances. He scrambled back to the music room and barricaded himself inside. His macaw, who was famished, peevishly latched on to one of his earlobes. Yet Duane Scrod Sr. gritted his teeth and remained silent in spite of the pain. He didn't want to go back to jail, although he realized that the odds were stacked against him. Attacking that tax man wasn't the brightest move he'd ever made. And he figured it was only a matter of time before his house was surrounded by heavily armed agents of the U.S. government. Earlier in the day, Duane Scrod Sr. had hidden from another stranger, a man who had knocked repeatedly and identified himself as a sheriff's deputy searching for Junior. Duane Sr. had snatched Nadine from her cage and run to cower under a quilt in the music room.
"Duane, open up, it's me, Nick Waters," the new visitor shouted.
Then a girl's voice said,
"I told you so, he's not even here."
It occurred to Duane Scrod Sr. that the persons on the porch might actually be looking for his son, but he quickly dismissed the idea. Except for one or two Miccosukee Indians, Junior didn't have any friends his own age. No, thought Duane Scrod Sr., this must be a trap. The FBI could be extremely sneaky. As soon as the voices outside stopped, Nadine let go of Duane Scrod Sr.'s ear. After a few minutes, he cautiously approached the small spinet piano that was blocking the music room door and prepared to push it aside.
"Ich habe Hunger,"
Nadine complained.
"Je faim."
"Hush up, bird," Duane Scrod Sr. whispered, "or I'll sell you to Colonel Sanders." A female voice from behind piped, "Don't do that." Duane Scrod Sr. wheeled around and cowered beside the piano. Framed in the open window were two faces, a boy and a girl, watching him. "What do you want?" he demanded. "Did the government send you two?" The boy said, "We go to school with Duane. We need to find him." "Yeah, well, get in line." "He's in our biology class," the girl added. Nadine screeched and flapped around the room two or three times before alighting on a dusty chandelier.
"Go away,"
Duane Scrod Sr. barked at the kids. He still wasn't convinced that they weren't FBI agents in disguise. The boy said, "Duane's running from the police. They're going to arrest him for arson, but we don't think he did it." "No, Nick," the girl interrupted, "you don't think he did it."
"Whatever. We've got to talk to him."
Duane Scrod Sr. said, "Even if I knew where he was, which I don't, I wouldn't tell you. So kindly take a hike, and I mean now." But the two kids didn't move. What's wrong with this world, thought Duane Scrod Sr. When did the grown-ups stop being in charge? "That's a nice piano," the girl remarked. "I've been taking lessons since I was 4.
"How thrilling for you," Duane Scrod Sr. grumbled. "Now get lost."
He was astounded to see both kids calmly climb through his window to enter the room. The girl said, "You know what I played at our fall recital? Rachmaninoff's Prelude No. 4 in D."
"You're kidding," Duane Scrod Sr. said.
Rachmaninoff was one of his all-time favorites. He slid the spinet away from the door, and the girl sat down on the piano bench and played the whole piece from memory. "That's downright lovely," Duane Scrod Sr. admitted. She said, "My name's Marta, and this is Nick."
"I'm Duane's dad, but I still can't tell you where he's at because I don't have a clue. Besides, you might be undercover FBI."
The girl said, "That's the dumbest thing I ever heard. I didn't even make the JV cheerleader squad." Duane Scrod Sr. reddened. The boy named Nick said, "Didn't you hear what happened at school yesterday?"
"Nope. Junior never came home is all I know."
"That's because he's a fugitive from justice," the girl named Marta said dramatically.
"Oh, that's great," Duane Scrod Sr. muttered.
The boy described what had occurred when the sheriff's detective went to the Truman School to arrest Duane Scrod Jr. for the arson at the Black Vine Swamp.
"But DJ said they didn't have any evidence," his father objected. "He promised me."
"They didn't have a thing until yesterday," said the boy named Nick. "Then they found his book bag at the scene of the fire." Now, Duane Scrott Sr. was really puzzled. DJ had a book bag? The girl sighed impatiently. For school, Mr. Scrod. It was camo-colored, the kid named Nick went on, like a hunter's backpack. Okay, yeah. Now Duane Scrott Sr. remembered the bag. When's the last time you saw it? The boy asked.
Day before yesterday.
The two kids whispered to each other, then the girl turned to Duane Scrott Sr. and asked, Are you 100% sure?
You bet I am. It was when the government tax man was here, violating my personal privacy. He grabbed Junior's bag off the floor and tried to murder my dear sweet Nadine with it. Ain't that right, darling?
Oui,
replied the macaw, rocking the chandelier. So where's the backpack now? The girl asked.
Beats me. Maybe the tax guy ran off with it.
Duane Scrott Sr. wondered how long he could put off calling Millicent Winship to tell her that her grandson was in trouble with the law again. The boy named Nick said, I don't think Duane is guilty. Duane Scrott Sr. coughed.
I dearly like to believe that's true, but DJ's got what they call a history with fires.
Well, this time he didn't do it, declared the boy. That's what he told me, and I believe him.
And what do you expect me to do, go march at the courthouse?
Duane Scrott Sr. shrugged. Junior won't come out of the woods till he's good and ready, and they'll never find him out there, not in a trillion years. When you hear from him,
who says I will?
But if you do, the girl named Marta said, tell him to quit running and turn himself in. That's the only way he'll clear his name. Duane Scrott Sr. cackled bitterly. This ain't the movies, you know. Life doesn't shake down so simple. The boy went out the window first. The girl followed, pausing briefly on the sill. She said, That's a sweet little piano. Do you play? Smoke's father shook his head.
Not in years.
Well, you should take it up again.
Yeah?
What for? Because you'll feel better. The girl said, and dropped out of sight. On the ride home, Nick was so agitated that he had trouble keeping his bike on the sidewalk. Don't you see? It's a total setup, he exclaimed to Marta. Smoke couldn't possibly have ditched his book bag in the swamp on the day of the fire because his father saw the same bag in the house 2 days ago. You know what? I remember seeing it under Smoke's desk in biology class the first day Waxmo was there. Marta said, Easy, dude. You're going to hyperventilate. I'm serious. Somebody stole his backpack, stashed a torch inside, and left it at the scene of the arson. Smoke's been framed. But why? That's crazy. Nick had to agree some vital pieces of the puzzle were missing. Although Duane Scrott Jr. kept to himself at Truman, he didn't seem to have made any enemies. Nick couldn't think of a single person who'd want to see the kid wrongfully locked up in jail. Don't forget, Marta said, the guy's dad is a major screwball, too. I mean, come on. Why would a tax collector steal a kid's book bag? What if he wasn't really a tax collector? Nick said. What if he went to Smoke's house just to take something that he could plant at the Black Vine Swamp, something incriminating? Marta gave a skeptical grunt. Now, don't get mad, she said. But here's another what if.
Okay.
What if Smoke had 2 book bags, Nick? One for his school stuff and one for his pyro gear. Nick was growing frustrated with Marta. Why couldn't she see what was happening? But he came over Thursday night to borrow my biology book, remember? He said he'd lost his backpack. I told you about it the next day. He also said he needed to study for a non-existent exam, Marta pointed out. The whole story was pretty sketchy. You said so yourself. Nick braked his bike under the shade of a tree and tried to gather his thoughts. Nothing about the fire in the Black Vine Swamp made much sense. From the disappearance of Mrs. Starch to the appearance of Duane Scrod Jr.'s backpack. Marta stopped her bicycle beside Nick's. What if Smoke heard his book bag had been found where the fire was set? And what if he was trying to make an alibi for himself by coming over and telling you he'd, quote, lost it? Then he gets his dad to lie and say the bag was in the house 2 days ago, but some stranger conveniently ripped it off. Nick said, I like my theory better. If he's not guilty, why did he run from Libby's dad? Because he was scared of getting arrested. He freaked out, that's all. Marta said, everybody says they're innocent no matter what. Don't you watch court TV? To himself, Nick admitted that it was possible that she was right and that Smoke was playing him for a sucker. But Nick's father always said to go with your gut. And Nick's gut said the kid was telling the truth. Marta, I still say he didn't do it. Fine. Then tell me one good reason why anyone in town would want to frame him. Name one person, okay? Nick. He wasn't listening. He had gotten off his bicycle and started jogging across the street. Come on, he called back to her. Are you cracking up or what? She shouted. Hurry! Nick motioned excitedly toward a strip mall. Marta hastily locked both bikes to the tree and ran after him. Mrs. Starch's Prius with the Save the Manatee license plate was parked outside a pizza joint called Little Napoli. The car was empty and unlocked. Nick checked around to make sure nobody was watching, then he dove into the back seat, leaving the door open for Marta. What exactly are you doing? She demanded, anxiously looking over her shoulder. Waiting for that Twilly guy or whoever's driving this thing. Get in. But he said he never wanted to lay eyes on us again. Or did you forget? Nick hadn't forgotten. He said, this is the only way we'll get some answers. I don't know about you, but I'm tired of being confused. Marta grimaced and clutched the sides of her head. Are you completely, totally nuts? I'd rather be confused than, like, dead. The dude had bullets in his belt, Nick. Real live bullets, which means he probably has a real live gun to put them in. I'm not moving, Nick said flatly. Either go on home or get in the car with me. But you'd better make up your mind fast, because here he comes. Marta got in the car. 18. The man named Twilly showed no reaction when he saw Nick and Marta in the back seat of the Prius. He sat down behind the wheel, placed two pizza boxes on the seat beside him, and started the car. Can you take us to Mrs. Starch? Nick said. Twilly didn't respond. In the rearview mirror, they could see that he was counting to himself. What are you doing? Marta asked him. You've got until the count of 20 to clear out of this car. Nick said, we're not moving till we get some answers. And if you try to throw us out, Marta added, I'll scream until somebody calls the cops. Twilly sighed and said, such drama. He turned in his seat and started backing the Prius out of the parking space. Marta pointed at him. What is that? Vulture beaks. A friend gave them to me, Twilly said, for good luck. Sun-bleached and crusty, the two beaks were tied to a frayed leather lanyard that dangled against his bare chest. Marta made a face at Nick and mouthed the word yuck. Twilly eased the car into traffic. Trying to mask his nervousness with conversation, Nick said, I'm reading one of Edward Abbey's books. It's sick. In the mirror, Twilly eyed him. I assume that means you like it? Yeah, he's funny. Was it a real monkey wrench gang? God, I wish. Twilly laughed to himself and pulled his ski cap down to his brow.
"How about you?" he said to Marta. "What do you read?" She said, "All the Harry Potters, 3 times. Seriously, did those gross things come from vultures?"
"Yep."
"So your friend..." "No, he didn't shoot them," Twilly said. "They were roadkills." Marta nodded, fascinated. "Aren't the beaks, like, magic or something?"
"That I wouldn't know."
As they passed the ramp to the interstate highway, heading farther and farther away from town, Nick wondered if he'd made a big mistake. They knew practically nothing about this man. He could be driving to Belle Glade to dump them in Lake Okeechobee. Nick said, "Mrs. Starch isn't really your aunt, is she?"
"Of course not," Twilly replied.
"So is she like your prisoner?" Marta asked bluntly. "We know you're out at the swamp during the school field trip because you're on a video that Nick took, wearing the same ammo belt that you've got on now. Are you the one who set the fire?" Nick sunk down in his seat. Once Marta got comfortable, she was capable of saying anything. To Nick, it seemed like a bad time to accuse Twilly of being a kidnapper and arsonist. Yet he didn't get mad. "So many pesky little questions," he said with a note of amusement. "First of all, I'm not holding dear Aunt Bunny prisoner. Anybody who tried to do that would live to regret it, I'm sure. And you're right, I was in the Blackvine Swamp that day. But I didn't light that fire. Somebody else did." "It wasn't smoke, was it?" Nick heard himself say. "Smoke?" "His real name is Duane Scrod, Jr.," Nick said. "Marta saw him riding in this car the other day. With you?" Twilly said, "I've been known to pick up hitchhikers." Nick went on, "Duane's in Mrs. Starch's biology class with us. Yesterday, a detective came to arrest him for the arson, but he got away." Marta was impatient. "He told Nick he's innocent, but the fire department found his book bag at the scene." In the mirror, Twilly's expression had grown serious. "The fire department didn't find it. A civilian found it and called the arson squad." "What's the difference?" Marta said.
"Huge difference, Princess."
"How do you know all this?" Nick asked excitedly. "Have you seen smoke?"
Twilly said, "That's enough chit-chat."
He handed one of the pizza boxes to Marta. "One more question, please," Nick implored. "And then we'll shut up, won't we, Marta?" She gave Nick a sarcastically polite smile before attacking the pizza. Twilly drummed his hands on the steering wheel. "Who really started that fire?" Nick asked.
"If I knew that, I'd..."
"You'd what?"
"Nothing," Twilly said, and turned up the radio very loud.
By the time Jimmy Lee Bayless arrived at the emergency room, Drake McBride was no longer bellowing at the nurses. This was because they'd given him an injection of special medicine to make him settle down and behave. They told Jimmy Lee Bayless that Drake McBride probably had a concussion from landing on his head, and possibly some broken ribs.
"King Thunderbolt threw me off,"
Drake McBride complained woozily.
"Then he did a dang tap dance on my chest."
Jimmy Lee Bayless sat down and said, "You're gonna be fine."
"They won't even let me see a doctor."
"You gotta wait, same as everyone else."
"But why? I'm not like everyone else,"
Drake McBride whined.
"I tried to give them some cash, let me go first, but they got all snotty and mad."
Jimmy Lee Bayless was glad he'd missed that scene. "You can't bribe a nurse. Hospital don't work that way."
"It wasn't a bribe. It was a tip."
Drake McBride paused to vomit in a plastic bedpan. Looking up, he said,
"Do me a favor, partner. Go out to the barn and shoot that no-good nag for me, would you? Before he cripples somebody named yours truly."
"Yes, sir," said Jimmy Lee Bayless, who had no intention of harming Drake McBride's horse. As on most Saturdays, the hospital emergency room bustled. Among those in the waiting area with Drake McBride were a middle-aged woman who'd crashed her moped into a mailbox
an older gentleman who'd been beaned by his doubles partner during a tennis match, and a surly young burglar, handcuffed to his chair, who'd been bitten by a police dog in a very sensitive area of his body.
"That shot made me dizzy," said Drake McBride, "and my head's still killing me."
Even though his boss was groggy and in pain, Jimmy Lee Bayless decided to go ahead and tell him.
"Sir, I got good news and bad news," he said.
Drake McBride groaned.
"Let me explain something. You got bad news, then there ain't no possible good news. The bad always cancels out the good."
Jimmy Lee Bayless lowered his voice. "They're gonna charge that pyro kid with doing the fire in Section 22, he said to Drake McBride. "That means we're in the clear."
"Okay, what else? Don't hold back just 'cause I'm sitting here with, like, 9 fractured ribs and a major brain injury."
Jimmy Lee Bayless told him first about Melton. "That bozo got ambushed again. This time they spray-painted him blaze orange from head to toe and tied him to the hood of his truck."
"Buck naked, same as before?"
Drake McBride asked weakly.
"Yes, sir."
"Was it a Red Diamond Company truck?"
"Lucky it was me who found him and not some outsider," Jimmy Lee Bayless said. "Otherwise it could have made the newspapers, even Fox TV. A naked orange guy in the middle of a swamp."
Drake McBride nodded somberly.
"Yeah, that's a winner. Thanks for ruining my day. It was already ruined pretty bad by that stupid horse."
Jimmy Lee Bayless wasn't finished.
"Whoever did it, they took the front axle off the pickup."
"The company pickup?"
"Yes, sir."
"I need to lie down."
Drake McBride slid off the chair and sprawled on the floor. The other patients sitting with their relatives ignored him.
"There's more," Jimmy Lee Bayless said. "The game warden called me this morning at the car wash. That's where I took Melton to scrub off his paint job."
Drake McBride groaned.
"State or federal game warden?"
"The feds. A wildlife agent, he called himself."
"Oh, don't tell me."
"Yeah, he got a report of a wild panther near our lease. He wants to come out and check around as soon as possible."
Drake McBride raised up.
"So what's the problem? You told me the cat was gone. You said the gunshots did the trick."
Jimmy Lee Bayless knew that his boss didn't have the quickest mind, but being dumped on his head had made Drake McBride unusually slow. The wildlife officer wouldn't need to find a live panther on the property in order to cause major problems for Red Diamond Energy. If he saw even a partial paw print or the tiniest, moldiest lump of scat, the government might step in to supervise the oil drilling operation, perhaps even halt it.
"The Endangered Species Act is a tough one," Jimmy Lee Bayless reminded Drake McBride, who cursed under his breath and collapsed once more on the dingy floor.
"And what if Officer Game Warden goes wandering off into Section 22, said Drake McBride, "and discovers our little private project there? I imagine we'd have some explaining to do, since that land belongs to the great state of Florida and not us."
"I think of something," Jimmy Lee Bayless said. "It'll be at least 10 days before we can sink the transfer pipe, so we'll be okay as long as we keep the guy focused on Section 21.
"And in the meantime, tell me your secret plan for cleaning up any old doo-doo that rotten cat left behind."
Jimmy Lee Bayless had no strategy for locating and removing panther poop. He said,
"There's 640 acres, but all we can do is pray for a good hard rain."
"During a drought? That's very funny."
Drake McBride covered his face with his hands and rocked sideways on the floor.
"I might just die here,"
he said miserably. Jimmy Lee Bayless wasn't feeling especially happy and carefree himself. Only 2 weeks earlier, he'd been looking at real estate brochures from Costa Rica, daydreaming about how he'd spend the millions of dollars he was going to make from the Red Diamond oil scam. Now he was worrying about staying out of prison. "We should give Melton a nice raise," he suggested. "He's really ticked off about what happened, and we sure don't want him blabbing all over town."
"The orange paint come off?" Drake McBride asked.
"Most of it. Certain places were hard to get to."
"You gotta find out who keeps doing this stuff and put a stop to it, whatever's necessary."
Jimmy Lee Bayless said, "I aim to, don't worry." A stern, broad-shouldered nurse walked up and told Jimmy Lee Bayless to move his boss back onto the chair.
"He's next up to see the doctor," she said. "After the lady with the wasp sting and the man with the barbecue burn."
"Glory be," murmured Drake McBride, and struggled to his knees.
Twilly Spree wasn't an outgoing person, and while he generally preferred the company of animals to that of human beings, he tried to be cautious in all relationships. Once he had become too fond of a dopey dog that he'd kidnapped from a knucklehead who had needed to be taught a hard lesson. Several lessons, in fact. When the time came to say goodbye to the dog, Twilly had found himself so sad and empty that it was alarming. Such sentimental feelings, he believed, could only distract him from his missions. The two kids in the back seat of the car weren't too obnoxious and probably meant well. Yet Twilly remained guardedly quiet during the drive to the Black Vine Swamp. His thoughts were on the boy who called himself Smoke, now a fugitive and in need of help. It was disturbing that Duane Scrod Jr. was being framed, and Twilly suspected that the Red Diamond Energy Corporation was behind the plot. Someone working at the company's drilling site had summoned the arson investigator, a brief meeting that Twilly had observed the previous day from his distant roost in a cypress tree. At the time, he hadn't known about the stolen book bag, but he put the whole story together after speaking with young Duane on the run, and later with a talkative secretary at the sheriff's office. Twilly reasoned that Red Diamond's only motive for pinning a bogus felony rap on an innocent kid was to hide its own involvement in the arson. Twilly didn't know why Red Diamond would ignite a brush fire to scare away school kids on a field trip, but he was working on theories. Because it was a new company, little information about Red Diamond was available on the Internet. However, private investigators hired by Twilly had dug up the name of the president and chief operating officer, Drake W. McBride, which was a beginning. Meanwhile, Twilly continued his sneak forays to the Section 21 lease, where the same poor dunce had twice confronted him, and both times had been dealt with somewhat firmly. Twilly Spree felt a tap on his shoulder. From the back seat, the boy named Nick Waters asked, "Could you please turn down the radio?"
"Nope," said Twilly.
"Then at least change the station," said the girl named Marta.
"Negative."
Twilly's driving music was classic rock, nothing else. Nick, hovering at his shoulder, asked, "Do you work for Mrs. Starch?"
"I told you, no more questions. Eat some pizza."
Marta said, "He doesn't like mushrooms or olives."
"Too bad."
Twilly opened the windows to blow out the cheesy pizza smell.
"For your information, I don't work for anybody," he said. "I'm what's known as unemployable."
"Are you, like, homeless?" asked Marta.
"Just the opposite. I can live anywhere."
Twilly was half tempted to pull over on a remote stretch of road and abandon the two kids, but he thought they might be helpful later. At the very least, it would be good for Duane Jr. to know that somebody else cared about him. Twilly turned off Route 29 onto a dusty farm road. A few minutes later, the Prius was inching down a bumpy, overgrown passage that had once been a railroad spur for a logging operation. The path ended at a broken gate that bore a rusty no trespassing sign. Twilly parked beneath a giant strangler fig, shut off the radio, and instructed his passengers to be still. He listened for the high-pitched whine of the oil company's helicopter, but the sky was quiet. Quickly he got out and began concealing the car with tree branches and palm fronds that he'd cut and stacked for that purpose. One-armed Nick Waters pitched in to help, but the girl named Marta apprehensively stood apart, brandishing her cell phone for Twilly to see. "Libby Marshall is number two on my speed dial, and her dad's a sheriff's detective. So don't get any crazy ideas," she warned. Twilly smiled. "I'll try to control myself. You ready to hike?" "Definitely," the boy said. "How far?" asked the girl. 20 minutes later, knee-deep in swamp water, she asked again in a much louder voice. Twilly raised a finger to his lips and continued wading. He led them along a boggy trail through a treeless marsh until they entered dry pine flatlands. There he saw recent signs of white-tailed deer, bobcats, and raccoons, although he didn't stop to point out the various tracks and scat. Twilly had no time to play nature guide. He was in a hurry. Balancing the pizza boxes on his free hand, the boy named Nick came up beside Twilly. In a hushed voice, he said, "Are there panthers out here? Didn't you hear one scream while you were on the field trip?" "No, that was you," Nick said. "Wasn't it?" Twilly winked and shook his head. "No way!" The boy looked thrilled. A few paces behind, the girl named Marta was griping. "Why can't we use the boardwalk like normal people? My brand-new Converses are totally trashed!" A red-shouldered hawk clutching a mouse in its talons passed overhead. Once more, Twilly paused to listen. The only sound from above was a woodpecker making holes in a dead tree. When Marta caught up, she said, "This is ridiculous. Where's Miss Starcher?" Twilly inserted two fingers in his mouth and whistled. There was no response, which was the agreed-upon signal for him to proceed. Suddenly, Marta blurted, "Nick, what if he's not really taking us to Mrs. Starch? What if he's going to chop us to pieces and feed us to the alligators?"
"Human flesh is tough. Gators prefer fish," Twilly noted and resumed walking. Nick remained at his side.
"She's just scared is all," he whispered.
Twilly understood. He was the first to admit that he wasn't a reliable-looking person. "Soon everything will become clear," he said. "More or less."
"I trust you."
"Well, Nick Waters, I wouldn't go that far."
"My father always says to stick with my gut instinct."
"He got hurt pretty bad in Iraq, right?"
Nick looked taken aback. "How'd you know that?"
"Dwayne mentioned it," Twilly said. "You didn't mess up your arm playing lacrosse like you told me, did you?"
"No, that was a lie."
"I figured. I never saw a back-assward sling like this before."
Twilly flicked the odd hump in the boy's shirt behind his right shoulder. He said, "Nothing wrong with my arm. I'm teaching myself to be a lefty."
"Like your old man's got to do."
Nick nodded and grew quiet.
"Good for you," Twilly said. He tried to recall if he'd ever cared about his own father as deeply as Nick Waters cared about his. The emotions were complicated, as were his childhood memories. From behind them, the girl called out,
"I hope you're both happy. I got blisters on my blisters."
They were now close enough that Twilly Spree could smell the woody haze from last night's campfire. "When's the last time you saw a wild panther?" he asked Nick.
"Never."
"And this is your lucky day."
19. The secret camp was in shadows beneath a tangled canopy of trees. There were two pup tents and a fire pit. Pegged to the ground was a faded green tarp, covering a chest-high stack of supplies. A flap opened on one of the tents, and a gangly figure crawled out. It was Mrs. Starch. She rose slowly, brushing herself off, her eyes blazing at the sight of Nick and Marta.
"What's the meaning of this?" she demanded.
"They carjacked me," Twilly said. "Sort of."
Mrs. Starch scowled. "Oh, please!" Despite the chilly reception, Nick was relieved to see his biology teacher unharmed and still as ornery as ever. Except for the straw hat, she had on the same clothes from the field trip, baggy long-sleeve shirt, canvas pants, and wading boots. Still, Mrs. Starch looked different, older and more tired. Her heavy makeup had worn off, and a stripe of coffee-brown roots bisected her mass of tinted blonde hair, which was tied in a ragged ponytail. There was no sign of her huge dragonfly sunglasses.
"It's your turn to entertain them. I'm heading out on poop patrol," Twilly told her, and sauntered back into the woods. Nick assumed he was taking a bathroom break. Mrs. Starch began pacing as she did in class. It had the same nerve-wracking effect on Marta as always. She turned greenish and queasy. Nick set the pizza boxes on a tree stump.
"What do you have to say for yourselves?" Mrs. Starch said.
Marta was in no condition to speak, and Nick had not yet composed a presentation. The best he could muster was, "We were worried."
"Worried? Or just plain nosy?" Mrs. Starch shot back. "It's rude enough that you broke into my home. Now this?"
Nick thought he heard a faint, muffled cry, but he couldn't tell where it came from. Still clutching her phone, Marta sat down on a log.